had put him in her arms after the delivery, had changed her mind. She named the boy Kelton after her paternal grandfather. The decision to keep the baby had frightened her a little, because she liked to see herself as a practical, sensible girl, and nothing which had happened to her over the last year or so fit that image. First, the practical, sensible girl had gotten pregnant out of wedlock in a time when practical, sensible girls simply did not do such things. Then, the practical, sensible girl had run away from home and delivered her child in a city where she had never been before and knew nothing about. And to top it all off, the practical, sensible girl had decided to keep the baby and take it with her into a future she could not see, could not even sense. At least, she had not kept the baby out of spite or defiance. No one could hang that on her. She found herself surprised by love, that simplest, strongest, and most unforgiving of all emotions. She had moved on. No, they had moved on. She had worked a number of menial jobs, and they had ended up in San Francisco, where she had intended to go all along. In that early summer of 1971, it had been a kind of hippie Xanadu, a hilly head shop full of freaks and folkies and yippies and bands with names like Moby Grape and 13th Floor Elevators. According to the Scott McKenzie song about San Francisco, which had been popular during one of those years, summertime was supposed to be a love-in there. Polly Chalmers, who had been no one's idea of a hippie even back then, had somehow missed the love-in. The building where she and Kelton lived was full of jimmied mailboxes and needle freaks who wore the peace sign around their necks and, more often than not, kept switchblades in their scuffed and dirty motorcycle boots. The most common visitors in this neighborhood were process servers, repo men, and cops. A lot of cops, and you didn't call them pigs to their faces. The cops had also missed the love-in, and they were pissed about it. Polly applied for welfare and found she had not lived in California long enough to qualify. She supposed things were different now, but in 1971, it had been as hard for a young unwed mother to get along in San Francisco as it was anywhere else. She applied for aid to dependent children and waited, hoped, for something to come of it. Kelton never went hungry, but she herself lived hand to mouth, a scrawny young woman who was often hungry and always afraid, a young woman very few of the people who knew her now would have recognized. Her memories of those first 3 years on the West Coast, memories stored at the back of her mind like old clothes in an attic, were skewed and grotesque. Images from a nightmare. And wasn't that a large part of her reluctance to tell Alan about those years? Didn't she simply want to keep them dark? She hadn't been the only one who had suffered the nightmare consequences of her pride, her stubborn refusal to ask for help, and the vicious hypocrisy of the times, which proclaimed the triumph of free love while simultaneously branding unmarried women with babies as creatures beyond the pale of normal society. Kelton had been there as well. Kelton had been her hostage to fortune as she slogged angrily along the track of her sordid fool's crusade. The horrible thing was that her situation had been slowly improving. In the spring of 1972, she had finally qualified for state help. Her first ADC check had been promised for the following month, and she had been making plans to move into a slightly better place when the fire happened. The call had come to her at the diner where she worked, and in her dreams, Norval, the short-order cook who had always been trying to get into her pants in those days, turned to her again and again, holding out the telephone. He said the same thing over and over. "Polly, it's the police. They want to talk to you. Polly, it's the police. They want to talk to you." They had indeed wanted to talk to her because they had hauled the bodies of a young woman and a small child from the smoky third floor of the apartment building. They had both been burned beyond recognition. They knew who the child was. If Polly wasn't at work, they would know who the woman was, too. For 3 months after Kelton's death, she had gone on working. Her loneliness had been so intense that she was half mad with it. So deep and complete that she hadn't even been aware of how badly she was suffering. At last she had written home, telling her mother and father only that she was in San Francisco, that she had given birth to a boy, and that the boy was no longer with her. She would not have given further details if she had been threatened with red-hot pokers. Going home had not been part of her plans then, not her conscious plans, at least. But it began to seem to her that if she did not reestablish some of her old ties, a valuable inside part of her would begin dying by inches, the way a vigorous tree dies from the branches inward when it is deprived of water too long. Her mother had replied at once to the box number Polly gave as a return address, pleading with her to come back to Castle Rock, to come home. She enclosed a money order for $700. It was very warm in the tenement flat where Polly had been living since Kelton's death, and she stopped halfway through the task of packing her bags for a cold glass of water. While she was drinking it, Polly realized that she was making ready to go home simply because her mother had asked, almost begged her, to do so. She hadn't really thought about it at all, which was almost certainly a mistake. It was that sort of look-before-you-leap behavior, not Duke Sheehan's puny little dingus, which had gotten her into trouble to begin with. So she sat down on her narrow, single woman's bed and thought about it. She thought long and hard. At last she voided the money order and wrote a letter to her mother. It was less than a page long, but it had taken her nearly 4 hours to get it right. I want to come back, or at least try it on for size, but I don't want us to drag out all the old bones and start chewing on them again if I do, she had written. I don't know if what I really want, to start a new life in an old place, is possible for anyone, but I want to try. So I have an idea. Let's be pen pals for a while. You and me and Dad. I have noticed it's harder to be angry and resentful on paper. So let's talk that way for a while, before we talk in person. They had talked that way for almost 6 months, and then one day in January of 1973, Mr. and Mrs. Chalmers had shown up at her door, bags in hand. They were registered at the Mark Hopkins Hotel, they said, and they were not going back to Castle Rock without her. Polly had thought this over, feeling a whole geography of emotions. Anger that they could be so high-handed, rueful amusement at the sweet and rather naive quality of that high-handedness, panic that the questions she had so neatly avoided answering in her letters would now be pressed home. She had promised to go to dinner with them, no more than that. Other decisions would have to wait. Her father told her he had only booked the room at the Mark Hopkins for a single night. You had better extend the reservation then, Polly said. She had wanted to talk with them as much as she could before coming to any final decision, a more intimate form of the testing which had gone on in their letters. But that first night had been the only night they had had. It was the last night she had ever seen her father well and strong, and she had spent most of it in a red rage at him. The old arguments, so easy to avoid in correspondence, had begun again even before pre-dinner glasses of wine were drunk. They were brush fires at first, but as her father continued to drink, they developed into an uncontrollable wall of fire. He had struck the spark, saying they both felt that Polly had learned her lesson and that it was time to bury the hatchet. Mrs. Chalmers had fanned the flames, dropping into her old, cool, sweetly reasonable voice. Where is the baby, dear? You might at least tell us that much. You turned him over to the sisters, I suppose. Polly knew these voices and what they meant from times long past. Her father's indicated his need to reestablish control. At all costs, there must be control. Her mother's indicated that she was showing love and concern in the only way she knew, by demanding information. Both voices, so familiar, so loved and despised, had ignited the old wild anger in her. They left the restaurant halfway through the main course, and the next day Mr. and Mrs. Chalmers had flown back to Maine alone. After a 3-month hiatus, the correspondence had begun again, hesitantly. Polly's mother wrote first, apologizing for the disastrous evening. The pleas to come home had been dropped. This surprised Polly, and filled some deep and barely acknowledged part of her with anxiety. She felt that her mother was finally denying her. This was, under the circumstances, both foolish and self-indulgent, but that did not change those elemental feelings in the slightest. "I suppose you know your own mind best," she wrote to Polly. "That's hard for your father and me to accept, because we still see you as our little girl. I think it frightened him to see you looking so beautiful and so much older. And you mustn't blame him too much for the way he acted. He hasn't been feeling well. His stomach has been kicking up on him again. The doctor says it's only his gallbladder, and once he agrees to have it taken out, all will be well, but I worry about him. Polly had replied in the same conciliatory tone. She found it easier to do so now that she had shelved her plans to return to Maine indefinitely. And then, near the end of 1975, the telegram had come. It was short and brutal. Your dad has cancer. He is dying. Please come home. Love, Mom. He was still alive when Polly got to the hospital in Bridgeton, her head spinning with jet lag and the old memories, seeing all the old places it prodded forth. The same wondering thought arose in her mind at each new turn of the road from the Portland jetport to Castle Rock. The last time I saw that, I was a child. Newton Chalmers lay in a private room, dozing in and out of consciousness, with tubes in his nose and machines gathered around him in a hungry semicircle. He died 3 days later. She had intended to go back to California right away. She almost thought of it as her home now. But 4 days after her father was buried, her mother suffered a crippling heart attack. Polly had moved into the house. She nursed her mother for the next 3.5 months, and at some point every night she would dream of Norval, the short-order cook, at Your Best Diner. Norval turned to her again and again in these dreams, holding the telephone out in his right hand, the one with the eagle and the words "Death Before Dishonor" tattooed on the back. "Polly, it's the police," Norval said. "They want to talk to you." "Polly, it's the police. They want to talk to you." Her mother was out of bed, on her feet again, and talking about selling the house and moving to California with Polly, something she would never do, but Polly did not disabuse her of her dreams. She was older by then, and a little kinder. When the second heart attack struck, so it was that on a raw afternoon in March of 1976, Polly had found herself in Homeland Cemetery, standing next to her great-aunt Evelyn, and looking at a coffin which stood on bands next to her father's grave. His body had lain in the homeland crypt all winter, waiting for the earth to unlimber enough so it could be interred. In one of those grotesque coincidences which no decent novelist would dare invent, the interral of the husband had taken place just 1 day before the wife died. The sods on top of Newton Chalmers's final apartment had not yet been replaced. The earth was still raw, and the grave looked obscenely naked. Polly's eyes kept straying from the coffin of her mother to the grave of her father. It was as if she was just waiting for him to be decently buried, she thought. When the short service was over, Aunt Evie had called her aside. Polly's last surviving relative stood by the Hay and Peabody funeral hack, a thin stick of a woman dressed in a man's black overcoat and strangely jolly red galoshes, a Herbert Tarrytan tucked into the corner of her mouth. She flicked a wooden match alight with one thumbnail as Polly approached and set fire to the tip of her cigarette. She inhaled deeply and then hacked the smoke back out into the cold spring air. Her cane, a simple ash stick, it would be 3 years yet before she would be awarded the Boston Post cane as the town's oldest citizen, was planted between her feet. Now, sitting in a Boston rocker that the old lady undoubtedly would have approved of, Polly calculated that Aunt Evie must have been 88 that spring. 88 years old and still smoking like a chimney, although she had not looked much different to Polly than she had when Polly was a little girl, hoping for a penny sweet from the apparently endless supply Aunt Evie kept in the pocket of her apron. Many things in Castle Rock had changed in the years she had been gone, but Aunt Evie was not one of them.
"Well, that's over," Aunt Evie had said in her cigarette raspy voice. "They're in the ground, Polly, mother and father both."
Polly had burst into tears then, a miserable flood of them. She thought at first that Aunt Evie would try to comfort her, and her flesh was already shrinking from the old woman's touch. She didn't want to be comforted, and need not have worried. Evelyn Chalmers had never been a woman who believed in comforting the grief-stricken, might in fact have believed, Polly sometimes thought later, that the very idea of comfort was an illusion. In any case, she only stood there with her cane planted between her red galoshes, smoking and waiting for Polly's tears to give way to sniffles as she brought herself under control. When this had been accomplished, Aunt Evie said, "Your chap, the one they spent so much time fussing over, is dead, isn't he?" Though she had guarded this secret jealously from everyone, Polly found herself nodding. "His name was Kelton."
"A goodish name," Aunt Evie said.
She drew on her cigarette and then exhaled slowly from her mouth so she could draw the smoke back up her nose, what Lorraine Chalmers had called a double pump, wrinkling her nose in distaste as she said it.
"I knew it from the first time you come over to see me after you got home. Saw it in your eyes."
"There was a fire," Polly said, looking up at her. She had a tissue, but it was too soggy to do any more business. She put it in her coat pocket and used her fists instead, screwing them into her eyes like a little girl who has fallen off her scooter and banged her knee. "The young woman I hired to babysit him probably started it."
"Yeah," Aunt Evie said. "But do you want to know a secret, Tricia?"
Polly nodded her head, smiling a little. Her real name was Patricia, but she had been Polly to everyone since her babyhood, everyone except Aunt Evie.
"Baby Kelton's dead, but you're not."
Aunt Evie tossed her cigarette away and used one bony forefinger to tap against Polly's chest for emphasis.
"You're not. So what are you going to do about it?"
Polly thought it over. "I'm going back to California," she said finally. "That's all I know."
"Yes, and that's all right for a start, but it's not enough."
And then Aunt Evie said something very close to what Polly herself would say some years later when she went to dinner at the Birches with Alan Pangborn.
"You're not the culprit here, Tricia. Have you got that sorted out?"
I don't know."
"Then you don't. Until you realize that, it won't matter where you go or what you do. There won't be any chance."
"What chance?" she had asked, bewildered.
"Your chance. Your chance to live your own life. Right now, you have the look of a woman who is seeing ghosts. Not everybody believes in ghosts, but I do. Do you know what they are, Tricia?"
She had shaken her head slowly.
"Men and women who can't get over the past," Aunt Evie said. "That's what ghosts are, not them."
She flapped her arm toward the coffin which stood on its bands beside the coincidentally fresh grave.
"The dead are dead. We bury them, and buried they stay."
"I feel..."
"Yes," Aunt Evie said. "I know you do, but they don't. Your mother and my nephew don't. Your chap, the one who died when you been away, he don't. Do you understand me?"
She had, a little anyway.
"You're right not to want to stay here, Polly. At least, you're right for now. Go back where you were, or go someplace new. Salt Lake, Honolulu, Baghdad, wherever you want. It don't matter, because sooner or later, you will come back here. I know that. This place belongs to you, and you belong to it. That's written in every line of your face, in the way you walk, the way you talk, even the way you have a narrow in your eyes when you look at someone you ain't met before. Castle Rock was made for you, and you for it. So there is no hurry. Go where ye list, as the good book says, but go there alive, Tricia. Don't be no ghost. If you turn into one of those, it might be better if you stayed away."
The old woman looked around broodingly, her head rotating above her cane.
"Goddamn town's got enough ghosts already," she said.
"I'll try, Aunt Evie."
"Yes, I know you will. Tryin', that's built into you, too."
Aunt Evie looked her over closely.
"You were a fair child, and a likely child, although you weren't ever a lucky child. Well, luck is for fools. It's all they have to hope for, poor devils. It strikes me that you are still likely and fair, and that's the important thing. I think you'll make out."
Then, briskly, almost arrogantly, "I love you, Tricia Chalmers. I always have." "I love you too, Aunt Evie." Then, in that careful way which the old and young have of showing affection, they embraced. Polly had smelled the old aroma of Aunt Evie's sachet, a tremor of violets, and that made her weep again. When she stood back, Aunt Evie was reaching into her coat pocket. Polly watched for her to bring out a tissue, thinking in an amazed way that at last, after all the long years, she would see the old woman cry. But she hadn't. Instead of a tissue, Aunt Evie brought out a single wrapped hard candy, just as she had in those days when Polly Chalmers had been a little girl with braids hanging over the front of her midi blouse. "Would you like a sweet, honey?" she had asked cheerfully. Twilight had begun to steal across the day. Polly straightened up in the rocker, aware that she had almost fallen asleep. She bumped one of her hands and a hard bolt of pain raced up her arm before being replaced once more by that hot, anticipatory tingle. It was going to be bad, all right. Later tonight or tomorrow, it was going to be very bad indeed. "Never mind what you can't change, Polly. There's at least one thing you can change, must change. You have to tell Alan the truth about Kelton. You have to stop harboring that ghost in your heart." But another voice rose up in response, an angry, frightened, clamorous voice, the voice of pride, she supposed, just that. But she was shocked by its strength and ardor as it demanded that those old days, that old life, not be exhumed, not for Alan, not for anybody, that, above all, her baby's short life and miserable death should not be given over to the sharp, wagging tongues of the town gossips. "What foolishness is that, Tricia?" Aunt Evie asked in her mind. Aunt Evie, who had died so full of years, double-pumping her beloved Herbert Tarrytons to the last. "What does it matter if Alan finds out how Kelton really died? What does it matter if every old gossip in town, from Lenny Partridge to Myrtle Keaton, knows? Do you think anyone cares a fig about your bun anymore, you silly goose? Don't flatter yourself. It's old news, hardly worth a second cup of coffee in Nan's." Maybe so, but he had been hers, God damn it, hers. In his life and in his death, he had been hers. And she had been hers, too. Not her mother's, her father's, Duke Sheehan's. She had belonged to herself. That frightened, lonely girl who had washed her panties out every night in the rusty kitchen sink because she had only three pairs. That frightened girl who always had a cold sore waiting to happen at the corner of her lip or on the rim of one nostril. That girl who sometimes sat at the window overlooking the air shaft and laid her hot forehead on her arms and cried. That girl was hers. Her memories of herself and her son together in the dark of night, Kelton feeding at one small breast while she read a John D. MacDonald paperback, and the disconnected sirens rose and raved through the cramped, hilly streets of the city, those memories were hers. The tears she had cried, the silences she had endured, the long, foggy afternoons in the diner, trying to avoid Norval Bates's Roman hands and Russian fingers, the shame with which she had finally made an uneasy peace, the independence and the dignity she had fought so hard and so inconclusively to keep. Those things were hers and must not belong to the town. "Polly, this is not a question of what belongs to the town, and you know it. It's a question of what belongs to Alan." She shook her head back and forth as she sat in the rocker, completely unaware she was making this gesture of negation. She supposed she had spent too many sleepless 3 o'clocks on too many endless dark mornings to give away her inner landscape without a fight. In time, she would tell Alan everything. She had not meant to keep the complete truth a secret even this long. But the time wasn't yet, surely not, especially when her hands were telling her that in the next few days she would not be able to think about much of anything at all except them. The phone began to ring. That would be Alan, back from patrol and checking in with her. Polly got up and crossed the room to it. She picked it up carefully, using both hands, ready to tell him the things she believed he wanted to hear. Aunt Evie's voice tried to intrude, tried to tell her that this was bad behavior, childishly self-indulgent behavior, perhaps even dangerous behavior. Polly pushed that voice aside quickly and roughly. "Hello?" she said brightly. "Oh, hi, Alan. How are you?" "Good." She listened briefly, then smiled. If she had looked at her reflection in the hallway mirror, she would have seen a woman who appeared to be screaming, but she did not look. "Fine, Alan," she said. "I'm just fine." It was almost time to leave for the raceway. Almost.
"Come on," Danforth Keaton whispered. Sweat ran down his face like oil. "Come on, come on, come on!"
He was sitting hunched over winning ticket. He had swept everything off his desk to make room for it, and he had spent most of the day playing with it. He had started with his copy of Bluegrass History, 40 Years of Kentucky Derby. He had run at least 2 dozen derbies, giving the 10 winning ticket horses the names of the entrants in exactly the manner Mr. Gaunt had described. And the 10 horses, which got the names of the winning derby horses from the book, kept coming in first. It happened time after time. It was amazing, so amazing that it was 4 o'clock before he realized that he had spent the day running long-ago races when there were 10 brand new ones to be run at Lewiston Raceway that very evening. Money was waiting to be made. For the last hour, today's Lewiston Daily Sun, folded to the racing card, had lain to the left of the winning ticket board. To the right was a sheet of paper he had torn from his pocket notebook. Listed on the sheet, in Keaton's large, hasty scrawl, was this. First race, Bazooka Joan. Second race, Philadelphia. Third race, Tammy's Wonder. Fourth race, I'm Amazed. Fifth race, By George. Sixth race, Pucky Boy. Seventh race, Casco Thunder. Eighth race, Delightful Sun. Ninth race, Tico Tico. It was only 5 in the afternoon, but Danforth Keaton was already running the last race of the night. The horses rattled and swayed around the track. One of them led by 6 lengths and crossed the finish line far ahead of the others. Keaton snatched up the newspaper and studied the evening's raceway card again. His face shone so brightly that he looked sanctified.
"Malabar!"
he whispered, and shook his fists in the air. The pencil caught in one of them, darted and plunged like a runaway sewing needle.
"It's Malabar! 30-1! 30-1 at least! Malabar, by God!"
He scribbled on the sheet of paper, panting raggedly as he did so. 5 minutes later, the winning ticket game was locked in his study closet, and Danforth Keaton was on his way to Lewiston in his Cadillac. At 9:45 on Sunday morning, Nettie Cobb drew on her coat and buttoned it swiftly. An expression of grim determination was stamped on her face. She was standing in her kitchen. Raider was sitting on the floor, looking up at her as if to ask if she really meant to go through with it this time. "Yes, I really mean it," she told him. Raider thumped his tail against the floor as if to say he knew she could do it. "I've made a nice lasagna for Polly, and I'm going to take it to her. My lampshade is locked up in the armoire, and I know it's locked, and I don't need to keep coming back to check because I know it in my head. That crazy Polish woman isn't going to keep me prisoner in my own house. If I see her on the street, I'll give her what for. I warned her." She had to go out. She had to, and she knew it. She hadn't left the house in 2 days, and she had come to realize that the longer she put it off, the harder it would become. The longer she sat in the living room with the shades pulled down, the harder it would become to ever raise them again. She could feel the old, confused terror creeping into her thoughts. So she had gotten up early this morning, at 5 o'clock, and had made a nice lasagna for Polly, just the way she liked it, with plenty of spinach and mushrooms. The mushrooms were canned because she hadn't dared go out to the market last night, but she thought it had turned out very well despite that. It was now sitting on the counter, the top of the pan covered with aluminum foil. She picked it up and marched through the living room to the door. "You be a good boy, Rada. I'll be back in an hour, unless Polly gives me coffee, and then it might be a little longer. But I'll be fine. I don't have a thing to worry about. I didn't do anything to that crazy Polish woman, Sheets, and if she bothers me, I'll give her the very dickens." Rader uttered a stern bark to show he understood and believed. She opened the door, peeked out, saw nothing. Ford Street was as deserted as only a small town street can be early on Sunday morning. In the distance, one church bell was calling Reverend Rose's Baptists to worship, and another was summoning Father Brigham's Catholics. Summoning all her courage, Nettie stepped out into the Sunday sunshine, set the pan of lasagna down on the step, pulled the door closed, and locked it. Then she took her house key and scratched it up her forearm, leaving a thin red mark. As she stooped to pick up the pan again, she thought, "Now, when you get halfway down the block, maybe even sooner, you'll start thinking that you didn't really lock the door after all. But you did. You set the lasagna down to do it. And if you still can't believe it, just look at your arm and remember that you made that scratch with your very own house key after you used the key to lock the house. Remember that, Nettie, and you'll be just fine when the doubts start to creep in." This was a wonderful thought, and using the key to scratch her arm had been a wonderful idea. The red mark was something concrete, and for the first time in the last 2 days, and mostly sleepless nights, Nettie really did feel better. She marched down the sidewalk, her head high, her lips pressed together so tightly that they almost disappeared. When she reached the sidewalk, she looked both ways for the crazy Polish woman's little yellow car. If she saw it, she intended to walk right up to it and tell the crazy Polish woman to leave her alone. There wasn't a sign of it, though. The only vehicle in sight was an old orange truck parked up the street, and it was empty. Good. Nettie set sail for Polly Chalmers's house, and when the doubts assailed her, she remembered that the carnival glass lampshade was locked up, Rader was on guard, and the front door was locked. Especially that last, the front door was locked, and she only had to look at the fading red mark on her arm to prove it to herself. So Nettie marched on with her head high, and when she reached the corner, she turned it without looking back. When the nutty woman was out of sight, Hugh Priest sat up behind the wheel of the orange town truck he had drawn from the deserted motor pool at 7 that morning. He had lain down on the seat as soon as he saw crazy Nettie come out the door. He put the gear shift in neutral and let the truck roll slowly and soundlessly down the slight grade to Nettie Cobb's house. The doorbell woke Polly from a soupy state that wasn't really sleep, but a kind of dream-haunted drug daze. She sat up in bed and realized she was wearing her housecoat. When had she put it on? For a moment she couldn't remember, and that frightened her. Then it came. The pain she'd been expecting had arrived right on schedule, easily the worst arthritic pain of her entire life. It had awakened her at 5. She had gone into the bathroom to urinate, then had discovered she couldn't even get a swatch of toilet paper off the roll to blot herself with. So she had taken a pill, put on her housecoat, and sat in the chair by the bedroom window to wait until it worked. At some point, she must have gotten sleepy and gone back to bed. Her hands felt like crude ceramic figures baked until they were on the verge of cracking. The pain was both hot and cold, set deep in her flesh like complex networks of poisoned wires. She held her hands up despairingly, scarecrow hands, awful, deformed hands, and downstairs the doorbell chimed again. She uttered a distracted little cry. She went out onto the landing with her hands held out in front of her like the paws of a dog sitting up to beg a sweet. "Who is it?" she called down. Her voice was hoarse, gummy with sleep. Her tongue tasted like something which had been used to line a cat box. "It's Nettie," the voice drifted back up. "Are you okay, Polly?" Nettie. Good God, what was Nettie doing here before the crack of dawn on Sunday morning? "I'm fine," she called back. I have to put something on. Use your key, dear." When she heard Nettie's key begin to rattle in the lock, Polly hurried back into her bedroom. She glanced at the clock on the table beside her bed and saw the dawn had cracked several hours before. Nor had she come back to put something on. Her housecoat would do for Nettie just fine. But she needed a pill. She had never, never in her life needed a pill as badly as she did now. She didn't know how bad her condition really was until she tried to take one. The pills, actually caplets, were in a small glass dish on the mantel of the room's ornamental fireplace. She was able to get her hand into the dish all right, but found herself completely unable to grasp one of the caplets once it was there. Her fingers were like the pincers of some machine which had frozen solid for lack of oil. She tried harder, concentrating all of her will on making her fingers close upon one of the gelatin capsules. She was rewarded with slight movement and a great burst of agony. That was all. She made a little muttering sound of pain and frustration. "Polly!" From the foot of the stairs now, Nettie's voice was concerned. People in Castle Rock might consider Nettie vague, Polly thought, but when it came to the vicissitudes of Polly's infirmity, Nettie was not vague at all. She had been around the house too long to be fooled, and had loved her too well. "Polly, are you really all right? Be right down, dear," she called back, trying to sound bright and lively. And as she took her hand out of the glass dish and bent her head over it, she thought, "Please, God, don't let her come up now. Don't let her see me doing this." She lowered her face into the dish like a dog about to drink from its bowl and stuck out her tongue. Pain, shame, horror, and most of all, a dark depression, all maroons and grays, enfolded her. She pressed her tongue against one of the caplets until it stuck. She drew it into her mouth, now not a dog, but an anteater ingesting a tasty morsel, and swallowed. As the pill traced its tiny, hard trail down her throat, she thought again, "I would give anything to be free of this. Anything. Anything at all." Hugh Priest rarely dreamed anymore. These days he did not go to sleep so much as fall unconscious. But he'd had a dream last night, a real lulu. The dream had told him everything he had to know, and everything he was supposed to do. In it, he had been sitting at his kitchen table, drinking a beer and watching a game show called Sale of the Century. All the things they were giving away were things he had seen in that shop, needful things, and all of the contestants were bleeding from their ears and the corners of their eyes. They were laughing, but they looked terrified. All at once a muffled voice began to call,
"Hugh! Hugh! Let me out, Hugh!"
It was coming from the closet. He went over and opened it, ready to cold cock whoever was hiding inside. But there was no one, only the usual tangle of boots, scarves, coats, fishing tackle, and his two shotguns.
"Hugh!"
He looked up, because the voice was coming from the shelf. It was the foxtail. The foxtail was talking, and Hugh recognized the voice at once. It was the voice of Leland Gaunt. He had taken the brush down, reveling again in its plushy softness, a texture that was a little like silk, a little like wool, and really like nothing at all but its own secret self.
"Thanks, Hugh," the foxtail said. "It's really stuffy in here, and you left an old pipe on the shelf. It really stinks. Phew!"
"Did you, want to go to another place?" Hugh had asked. He felt a little stupid talking to a foxtail, even in a dream.
"No, I'm getting used to it. But I have to talk to you. You have to do something, remember?
You promised."
"Crazy Nettie," he agreed. "I have to play a trick on Crazy Nettie."
"That's right," said the foxtail, "and you have to do it as soon as you wake up. So listen."
Hugh had listened. The foxtail had told him no one would be home at Nettie's but the dog, but now that Hugh was actually here, he decided it would be wise to knock. He did so. From inside, he heard claws come clicking rapidly across a wooden floor, but nothing else. He knocked again, just to be safe. There was a single stern bark from the other side of the door.
"Rada?" Hugh asked. The foxtail had told him that was the dog's name. Hugh thought it was a pretty good name, even if the lady who thought it up was nuttier than a fruitcake. The single bark came again, not quite so stern this time. Hugh took a key ring from the breast pocket of the plaid hunting jacket he wore and examined it.
He'd had this ring for a long time and could no longer even remember what some of the keys had gone to. But four of them were skeleton keys, easily identified by their long barrels, and these were the ones he wanted. Hugh glanced around once, saw the street was as deserted as it had been when he first arrived, and began to try the keys, one by one. When Nettie saw Polly's white, puffy face and haggard eyes, her own fears, which had gnawed at her like sharp weasel's teeth as she walked over, were forgotten. She didn't even have to look at Polly's hands, still held out at waist level. It hurt dreadfully to let them hang down when they were like this, to know how things were with her. The lasagna was thrust unceremoniously on a table by the foot of the stairs. If it had gone tumbling to the floor, Nettie wouldn't have given it a second glance. The nervous woman Castle Rock had grown used to seeing on its streets, the woman who looked as if she were skulking away from some nasty piece of mischief, even if she was only on her way to the post office, was not here. This was a different Nettie, Polly Chalmers's Nettie. "Come on," she said briskly, "into the living room. I'll get the thermal gloves." "Nettie, I'm all right," Polly said weakly. "I just took a pill, and I'm sure that in a few minutes..." But Nettie had an arm around her and was walking her into the living room. "What did you do? Did you sleep on them, do you think?" "No. That would have woken me. It's just..." She laughed. It was a weak, bewildered sound. "It's just pain. I knew today was going to be bad, but I had no idea how bad. And the thermal gloves don't help." "Sometimes they do. You know that sometimes they do. Now just sit there." Nettie's tone brooked no refusal. She stood beside Polly until Polly sat in an overstuffed armchair. Then she went into the downstairs bathroom to get the thermal gloves. Polly had given up on them a year ago, but Nettie, it seemed, held for them a reverence that was almost superstitious. Nettie's version of chicken soup, Alan had once called them, and they had both laughed. Polly sat with her hands resting on the arms of the chair, like lumps of cast-off driftwood, and looked longingly across the room at the couch where she and Alan had made love Friday night. Her hands hadn't hurt at all then, and that already seemed like 1,000 years ago. It occurred to her that pleasure, no matter how deep, was a ghostly, ephemeral thing. Love might make the world go round, but she was convinced it was the cries of the badly wounded and deeply afflicted which spun the universe on the great glass pole of its axis. "Oh, you stupid couch," she thought. "Oh, you stupid, empty couch. What good are you to me now?" Nettie came back with the thermal gloves. They looked like quilted oven mitts connected by an electric cord. A plug-in cord snaked out of the left glove's back. Polly had seen an ad for the gloves in Good Housekeeping, of all places. She had placed a call to the National Arthritis Foundation's 800 number and had ascertained that the gloves did indeed provide temporary relief in some cases. When she showed the ad to Dr. Van Allen, he added the coda, which had been tiresomely familiar even 2 years ago. "Well, it can't hurt." "Nettie, I'm sure that in a few minutes..." "You'll feel better," Nettie finished. "Yes, of course you will. And maybe these will help. Hold up your hands, Polly." Polly gave in and held up her hands. Nettie held the gloves by their ends, squeezed them open, and slipped them on with the delicacy of a bomb squad expert covering packets of C4 with a blast blanket. Her touch was gentle, expert, and compassionate. Polly didn't believe the thermal gloves would do a thing, but Nettie's obvious concern had already had its effect. Nettie took the plug, got down on her knees, and slipped it into the baseboard socket near the chair. The gloves began to hum faintly, and the first tendrils of dry warmth caressed the skin of Polly's hands. "You're too good to me," Polly said softly. "Do you know that?"
"I couldn't be," Nettie replied. "Not ever."
Her voice was a trifle husky, and there was a bright, liquid shine in her eyes. "Polly, it's not my place to tell you your business, but I just can't keep quiet any longer. You have to do something about your poor hands. You have to. Things just can't go on this way."
"I know, dear. I know."
Polly made a huge effort to climb over the wall of depression which had built itself up in her mind.
"Why did you come over, Nettie? Surely it wasn't just to toast my hands."
Nettie brightened. "I made you a lasagna."
"Did you? Oh, Nettie, you shouldn't have.
No, that's not what I think. I think you won't be up to cooking today or tomorrow either. I'll just put it in the refrigerator.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm glad I did it. Doubly glad now that I see you.
She reached the hall doorway and looked back. A bar of sun fell across her face, and in that moment Polly might have seen how drawn and tired Nettie looked if her own pain had not been so large.
Don't you move now.
Polly burst out laughing, surprising them both.
I can't. I'm trapped.
In the kitchen, the refrigerator door opened and closed as Nettie put the lasagna away. Then she called,
Shall I put on the coffee? Would you like a cup? I could help you with it.
Yes, Polly said. That would be nice. The gloves were humming louder now. They were very warm, and either they were actually helping or the pill was taking hold in a way the one at 5 o'clock hadn't. More probably, it was a combination of the two, she thought.
But if you have to get back, Nettie...
Nettie appeared in the doorway. She had taken her apron out of the pantry and put it on, and she held the old tin coffee pot in one hand. She wouldn't use the new digital Toshiba coffee maker, and Polly had to admit that what came out of Nettie's tin pot was better.
I've no place to go that's better than this, she said. Besides, the house is all locked up and Rader's on guard.
I'm sure, Polly said, smiling. She knew Rader very well. He weighed all of 20 pounds and rolled over to have his belly scratched when anyone, mailman, meter reader, door-to-door salesman, came to the house.
I think she'll leave me alone anyway, Nettie said. I wander. I haven't seen her around or heard from her, so I guess it finally sank in on her that I meant business.
Warned who? About what?
Polly asked, but Nettie had already left the doorway, and Polly was indeed penned in her seat by the electric gloves. By the time Nettie reappeared with the coffee tray, the Percodan had begun to fog her in, and she had forgotten all about Nettie's odd remark, which was not surprising in any case, since Nettie made odd remarks quite often. Nettie put cream and sugar in Polly's coffee and held it up so she could sip from the cup. They chatted about one thing and another, and of course the conversation turned to the new shop before very long. Nettie told her about the purchase of the carnival glass lampshade again, but hardly in the breathless detail Polly would have expected, given the extraordinary nature of such an event in Nettie's life. But it kicked off something else in her mind, the note Mr. Gaunt had put in the cake container.
I almost forgot. Mr. Gaunt asked me to stop by this afternoon. He said he might have an item I'd be interested in.
You're not going, are you, with your hands like they are?
I might. They feel quite a little bit better. I think the gloves really did work this time, at least a little. And I have to do something.
She looked at Nettie a trifle pleadingly.
Well, I suppose.
A sudden idea struck Nettie.
You know, I could walk by there on the way home and ask him if he could come to your house.
Oh, no, Nettie, that's out of your way.
Only a block or two. Nettie cast an endearingly sly side glance Polly's way. Besides, he might have another piece of carnival glass. I don't have enough money for another one, but he doesn't know that, and it doesn't cost anything to look, does it?
But to ask him to come here...
I'll explain how it is with you, Nettie said decisively, and began putting things back on the tray. Why, businessmen often have home demonstrations, if they have something worth selling, that is.
Polly looked at her with amusement and love.
You know, you're different when you're here, Nettie.
Nettie looked at her, surprised.
I am?
Yes.
How?
In a good way. Never mind. Unless I have a relapse, I think I will want to go out this afternoon. But if you do happen to go by needful things...
I will.
A look of ill-concealed eagerness shone in Nettie's eyes. Now that the idea had occurred to her, it took hold with all the force of a compulsion. Doing for Polly had been a tonic for her nerves, and no mistake.
And if he does happen to be in, give him my home number and ask him to give me a call if the item he wanted me to see came in. Could you do that?
You betcha, Nettie said.
She rose with the coffee tray and took it into the kitchen. She replaced her apron on its hook in the pantry and came back into the living room to remove the thermal gloves. Her coat was already on. Polly thanked her again, and not just for the lasagna. Her hand still hurt badly, but the pain was manageable now, and she could move her fingers again.
You're more than welcome, Nettie said. And you know what? You do look better. Your color's coming back. It scared me to look at you when I first came in. Can I do anything else for you before I go?
No, I don't think so.
She reached out and clumsily grasped one of Nettie's hands in her own, which were still flushed and very warm from the gloves. I'm awfully glad you came over, dear.
On the rare occasions when Nettie smiled, she did it with her whole face. It was like watching the sun break through the clouds on an overcast morning.
I love you, Polly.
Touched, Polly replied,
Why, I love you too, Nettie.
Nettie left. It was the last time Polly ever saw her alive.
The lock on Nettie Cobb's front door was about as complex as the lid of a candy box. The third skeleton key Hugh tried worked after a little jiggling and joggling. He opened the door. A small dog, yellow with a white bib, sat on the hall floor. He uttered his single stern bark as morning sunlight fell around him and Hugh's large shadow fell on him.
You must be Rada, Hugh said softly, reaching into his pocket.
The dog barked again and promptly rolled over on his back, all four paws splayed out limply.
Say, that's cute, Hugh said.
Raider's stub of a tail thumped against the wooden floor, presumably in agreement. Hugh shut the door and squatted beside the dog. With one hand, he scratched the right side of the dog's chest in that magic place that is somehow connected to the right rear paw, making it flail rapidly at the air. With his other, he drew a Swiss Army knife out of his pocket.
"Aw, ain't you a good fella," Hugh crooned. "Ain't you a one?"
He left off scratching and took a scrap of paper from his shirt pocket. Written on it, in his labored schoolboy script, was the message the foxtail had given him. Hugh had sat down at his kitchen table and written it even before he got dressed, so he wouldn't forget a single word.
"Nobody slings mud at my clean sheets. I told you I'd get you."
He pulled out the corkscrew hidden in one of the fat knife slots and stuck the note on it. Then he turned the body of the knife sideways and closed his fist over it so the corkscrew protruded between the second and third fingers on his powerful right hand. He went back to scratching Raider, who had been lying on his back through all this, eyeing Hugh cheerfully. He was cute as a bug, Hugh thought.
"Yes! Ain't you just the best old fella? Ain't you just the best old one?" Hugh asked, scratching.
Now both rear legs were flailing. Raider looked like a dog pedaling an invisible bike.
"Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And do you know what I've got? I've got a foxtail. Yes, I do."
Hugh held the corkscrew with the note pinned to it over the white bib on Raider's breast.
"And do you know what else?
I'm gonna keep it."
He brought his right hand down hard. The left, which had been scratching Raider, now pinned the dog as he gave the corkscrew three hard twists. Warm blood jetted up, dousing both of his hands. The dog rattled briefly on the floor and then lay still. He would utter his stern and harmless bark no more. Hugh stood up, his heart thumping heavily. He suddenly felt very bad about what he had done, almost ill. Maybe she was crazy, maybe not, but she was alone in the world, and he had killed what was probably her only goddamn friend. He wiped his bloody hand across his shirt. The stain hardly showed at all on the dark wool. He couldn't take his eyes off the dog. He had done that. Yes, he had done it, and he knew it, but he could hardly believe it. It was as if he had been in a trance or something. The inner voice, the one that sometimes talked to him about the AA meeting, spoke up suddenly.
"Yes, and I suppose you'll even be able to make yourself believe it, given time, but you weren't in any fucking trance. You knew just what you were doing. And why?"
Panic began to race through him. He had to get out of here. He backed slowly down the hall, then uttered a hoarse cry as he ran into the closed front door. He fumbled behind him for the knob, unmindful of any fingerprints he might be leaving, and at last found it. He turned the knob, opened the door, and slid out of Crazy Nettie's house. He looked around wildly, somehow expecting to see half the town gathered in front of the house, watching him with solemn, judicial eyes. He saw no one but a kid pedaling up the street. There was a Playmate picnic cooler propped at an odd angle in the basket of the kid's bike. The kid spared Hugh Priest not so much as a glance as he went by, and when he was gone, there were only the church bells. This time they were calling the Methodists. Hugh hurried down the walk. He told himself not to run, but he was trotting by the time he reached his truck just the same. He fumbled the door open, slid in behind the wheel, and stabbed the ignition key at the slot. He did this 3 or 4 times, and the fucking key kept going astray. He had to steady his right hand with his left before he could finally get it to go where it belonged. His brow was dotted with fine beads of sweat. He had suffered through many hangovers, but he had never felt like this. This was like coming down with malaria or something. The truck started with a roar and a belch of blue smoke. Hugh's foot slipped off the clutch. The truck took 2 large, snapping jerks away from the curb and stalled. Breathing harshly through his mouth, Hugh got it started again and drove away fast. By the time he got to the motor pool, it was still as deserted as the mountains of the moon, and exchanged the town truck for his old dented Buick, he had forgotten all about Raider and the horrible thing he had done with the corkscrew. He had found something else, something much more important, to think about. During the drive back to the motor pool, he had been gripped with a feverish certainty. Someone had been in his house while he was gone, and that someone had stolen his foxtail. Hugh drove home at better than 60, came to a stop 4 inches from his rickety porch in a squash of gravel and a cloud of dust, and ran up the steps 2 at a time. He burst in, ran to the closet, and yanked the door open. He stood on his toes and began to explore the high shelf with his panicky, fluttering hands. At first they felt nothing but bare wood, and Hugh sobbed in fright and rage. Then his left hand sank deep into that rough plush that was neither silk nor wool, and a great sense of peace and fulfillment slipped over Hugh. It was like food to the starving, rest to the weary, quinine to the malarial. The staccato drum roll in his chest finally began to ease. He drew the foxtail down from its hiding place and sat at the kitchen table. He spread it across his fleshy thighs and began to stroke it with both hands. Hugh sat like that for better than 3 hours. The boy Hugh saw but failed to recognize, the one on the bike, was Brian Rusk. Brian had had his own dream last night and had his own errand to run this morning in consequence. In his dream, the 7th game of the World Series was about to start, some ancient Elvis-era World Series featuring the old apocalyptic rivalry, that baseball avatar, the Dodgers versus the Yankees. Sandy Koufax was in the bullpen, warming up for DeBums. He was also speaking to Brian Rusk, who stood beside him, between pitches. Sandy Koufax told Brian exactly what he was supposed to do. He was very clear about it. He dotted every I and crossed every T. No problem there. The problem was this. Brian didn't want to do it. He felt like a creep, arguing with a baseball legend like Sandy Koufax, but he tried just the same. "You don't understand, Mr. Koufax," he said. "I was supposed to play a trick on Wilma Jurczyk, and I did. I already did."
"So what?" Sandy Koufax said. "What's your point, Bush?"
"Well, that was the deal. 85 cents in one trick."
"You sure of that, Bush? One trick? Are you sure? Did he say something like, not more than one trick? Something legal like that?"
Brian couldn't quite remember, but the feeling that he'd been had was growing steadily stronger inside him. No, not just had. Trapped, like a mouse with a morsel of cheese.
"Let me tell you something, Bush. The deal..."
He broke off and uttered a little as he threw a hard overhand fastball. It popped into the catcher's mitt with a rifle shot crack. Dust drifted up from the mitt, and Brian realized with dawning dismay that he knew the blue eyes looking at them from behind the catcher's mask. Those eyes belonged to Mr. Gaunt. Sandy Koufax caught Mr. Gaunt's return toss, then glanced at Brian with flat eyes like brown glass.
"The deal is whatever I say the deal is, Bush."
Sandy Koufax's eyes weren't brown at all, Brian had realized in his dream. They were also blue, which made perfect sense, since Sandy Koufax was also Mr. Gaunt. But
Koufax Gaunt raised his gloved hand. "Let me tell you something, Bush. I hate that word. Of all the words in the English language, it is easily the worst. I think it's the worst word in any language. You know what a butt is, Bush? It's the place shit comes out of.
The man in the old-fashioned Brooklyn Dodgers uniform hid the baseball in his glove and turned to face Brian fully. It was Mr. Gaunt, all right, and Brian felt a freezing, dismal terror grip his heart.
I did say I wanted you to play a trick on Wilma, Brian. That's true. But I never said it was the one and only trick I wanted you to play on her.
You just assumed, Bush. Do you believe me, or would you like to hear the tape of our conversation?
I believe you, Brian said. He was perilously close to blubbering now. I believe you, but what did I just tell you about that word, Bush?
Brian dropped his head and swallowed hard.
You've got a lot to learn about dickering, Koufax Gaunt said. You and everyone else in Castle Rock. But that's one of the reasons I came, to conduct a seminar in the fine art of dickering. There was one fellow in town, a gent named Merrill, who knew a little something about it, but he's gone to that big rummage sale barn in the sky. He grinned, revealing Leland Gaunt's large, uneven teeth and Sandy Koufax's narrow, brooding face. And the word bargain, Brian. I have some tall teaching to do on that subject as well.
But
the word was out of Brian's mouth before he could call it back. No buts about it, Koufax Gaunt said. He leaned forward. His face stared solemnly at Brian from beneath the bill of his baseball cap. Mr. Gaunt knows best. Can you say that, Brian?
Brian's throat worked, but no sound came out. He felt hot, loose tears behind his eyes. A large, cold hand descended upon Brian's shoulder and gripped.
Say it!
Mr. Gaunt!
Brian had to swallow again to make room for the words.
Mr. Gaunt knows best.
That's right, Bush. That's exactly right. And what that means is you're going to do what I say, or else.
Brian summoned all his will and made one final effort.
What if I say no anyway? What if I say no because I didn't understand the, what do you call them, the terms?
Koufax Gaunt picked the baseball out of his glove and closed his hand over it. Small drops of blood began to sweat out of the stitches.
You really can't say no, Brian, he said softly. Not anymore. Why, this is the seventh game of the World Series. All the chickens have come home to roost. It's time to shit or git. Take a look around you. Go on and take a good look.
Brian looked around and was horrified to see that Ebbets Field was so full they were standing in the aisles, and he knew them all. He saw his ma and pa sitting with his little brother, Sean, in the commissioner's box behind home plate. His speech therapy class, flanked by Miss Ratcliffe on one end and her big dumb boyfriend, Lester Pratt, on the other, was ranged along the first base line, drinking Royal Crown Cola and munching hot dogs. The entire Castle Rock Sheriff's Office was seated in the bleachers, drinking beer from paper cups with pictures of this year's Miss Rheingold contestants on them. He saw his Sunday school class, the town selectmen, Myra and Chuck Evans, his aunts, his uncles, his cousins. There, sitting behind third base, was Sonny Jacket, and when Koufax Gaunt threw the bleeding ball and it made that rifle shot crack in the catcher's glove again, Brian saw that the face behind the mask now belonged to Hugh Priest.
Run you down, little buddy, Hugh said as he threw the ball back. Make you squeak.
You see, Bush, it's not just a question of the baseball card anymore, Koufax Gaunt said from beside him. You know that, don't you? When you slung that mud at Wilma Jurzik's sheets, you started something. Like a guy who starts an avalanche just by shouting too loud on a warm winter day. Now your choice is simple. You can keep going, or you can stay where you are and get buried. In his dream, Brian finally began to cry. He saw all right. He saw just fine, now that it was too late to make any difference. Gaunt squeezed the baseball. More blood poured out, and his fingertips sank deep into its white, fleshy surface. If you don't want everybody in Castle Rock to know you were the one who started the avalanche, Brian, you had better do what I tell you. Brian wept harder. When you deal with me, Gaunt said, winding up to throw, you want to remember two things. Mr. Gaunt knows best, and the dealing isn't done until Mr. Gaunt says the dealing's done. He threw with that sinuous, all-of-a-sudden delivery which had made Sandy Koufax so hard to hit. That was, at least, the humble opinion of Brian's father. And when the ball hit Hugh Priest's glove this time, it exploded. Blood and hair and stringy gobbets of flesh flew up into the bright autumn sun. And Brian had awakened, weeping into his pillow. Now he was off to do what Mr. Gaunt had told him he must do. It had been simple enough to get away. He simply told his mother and father he didn't want to go to church that morning because he felt sick to his stomach, nor was this a lie. Once they were gone, he made his preparations. It was hard to pedal his bike and even harder to keep it balanced because of the Playmate picnic cooler in the bike basket. It was very heavy, and he was sweating and out of breath by the time he reached the Jurzik house. There was no hesitation this time, no ringing the doorbell, no pre-planned story. No one was here. Sandy Koufax, Leland Gaunt, had told him in the dream that the Jurziks would be staying late after the 11 o'clock mass to discuss the upcoming casino night festivities and would then be going to visit friends. Brian believed him. All he wanted now was to finish with this awful business just as fast as he could. And when it was done, he would go home, park his bike, and spend the rest of the day in bed. He lifted the picnic cooler out of the bike basket using both hands and set it down on the grass. He was behind the hedge where no one could see him. What he was about to do would be noisy, but Koufax Gaunt had told him not to worry about that. He said that most of the people on Willow Street were Catholics, and almost all of those not attending 11 o'clock mass would have gone at 8 and then left on their various Sunday day trips. Brian didn't know if this was true or not. He only knew two things for sure. Mr. Gaunt knew best, and the deal wasn't done until Mr. Gaunt said the deal was done. And this was the deal. Brian opened the Playmate cooler. There were about a dozen rocks inside, each about the size of a baseball. Wrapped around each and held with a rubber band or two was a sheet of paper from Brian's school notebook. Printed on each sheet in large letters was this simple message. I told you to leave me alone. This is your last warning. Brian took one of these and walked up the lawn until he was less than 10 feet from the Jurzik's big living room window, what had been called a picture window back in the early 60s when this house had been built. He wound up, hesitated for only a moment, and then let fly like Sandy Koufax facing the leadoff batter in the 7th game of the World Series. There was a huge and unmusical crash, followed by a thud as the rock hit the living room carpet and rolled across the floor. The sound had an odd effect on Brian. His fear left him, and his distaste for this further task, which could by no stretch of the imagination be dismissed as something so inconsequential as a prank, also evaporated. The sound of breaking glass excited him, made him feel, in fact, the way he felt when he had his daydreams about Miss Ratcliffe. Those had been foolish, and he knew that now, but there was nothing foolish about this. This was real. Besides, he found that he now wanted the Sandy Koufax card more than ever. He had discovered another large fact about possessions and the peculiar psychological state they induce. The more one has to go through because of something one owns, the more one wants to keep that thing. Brian took two more rocks and walked over to the broken picture window. He looked inside and saw the rock he had thrown. It was lying in the doorway.